So I just introduced myself, and I was mentioning that what I'm going to tell you today has two strong connections with experiments. So that's what I wanted to highlight: James Thomson cavity QED experiment at Gila. And the work that I'm going to talk today, it's based on two papers. But if you want me to send you some slides, I can also send you some slides on the topic. What is the goal? What we want to do is to use atoms in a cavity to simulate many body physics on one hand. So basically, we want to study driven dissipative systems. So one of the first, of course, if you want to show interesting physics, you have to show interactions. So one of the first things that we did is to show that actually we can exchange interactions in the system. And this work was published in Science last year. And then I'm going to follow up with a paper that was just appeared in PRA last week. I want to highlight the work of Diego Barbarena. He's a graduate student at Gila. And Robert Lewitt-Swan, he's a postdoc. And this, the title of this paper is on driven dissipative systems. So it's a little bit of follow-up on this work, but with an additional ingredients. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. So basically, the title of my talk is New Directions on Quantum Simulation with Low-Leaf Strontium Dipoles in a Cavity. I'm going to explain you why the strontium dipoles is important and why the cavity is important, and basically what we want to push. We want to system, so our goal is as I said, to explore interesting many body physics. But the other, and this is very important for NIST, for us, is for quantum metrology. So far, there has not been a demonstration of enhanced metrology in an optical transition that is relevant for clocks. So I'm going to tell you how we are thinking that we can push for the first time this direction. So basically, and also feel free to interrupt me anytime. So what is the motivation of this work? Well, we know in some sense that basically when we look at many body systems, thermodynamics, and statistical mechanics, are kind of the pillars of physics, yes? They have allowed us to classify different phases of matter, and if you think about the idea of using ultra-cold atomic systems for quantum simulation, in principle, one of the first goals was towards that, trying to simulate the Hoare model phase diagram, many things that happen at the equilibrium. But however, I think for cold atoms, and this is something that Shaishuan was mentioning yesterday, for atoms actually going from here to non-equilibrium conditions is kind of simpler. Because in some sense, these atomic systems are more tunable, and we are able to actually look at the dynamical evolution, even in real time. So we just tune some knobs, and we look at what is the system, what is the time evolution for some amount of time. So I would say non-equilibrium systems are more amenable experimentally. So for experiments, this is more easier. So I think this is easier, simpler. You just prepare a very well, simple initial state, and you look at the system as it evolves. But on the other hand, we know that for theory, this is a very big challenge, because for theory, then we are in trouble, because actually all these tools that thermodynamics, statistical mechanics has taught us how to deal with systems doesn't follow. And first, for example, like a minimization of free energy doesn't follow. This is something. Also, these systems, as the time evolves, ended up being strongly entangled and correlated. So this is other things. Uh, time correlated as a function of time. And this is complicated, but even more interesting, it's opening to the existence of new phenomena that cannot exist at equilibrium. So, new phases. All of equilibrium. So these are forbidden and cannot be stable when you are talking about, for example, ground state or something like that. And I think this is going to be mostly the focus of this talk. What is the new phases that can you actually see and tolerate out of equilibrium? And in tunable systems, in some degree, cavity QED are amenable, because I will tell you we can simulate now 10 to the 4 atoms in exact solutions in some degree, because these systems are long range and are collective, so the restrictions to solve numerical for these systems is not that hard. So we can actually even tackle numerical or almost analytically what is the conditions of the entangling states as a function of time, and discover actually new phenomena out of equilibrium. So that's going to be kind of the essence of the talk. So I think, time is ripe for that. So experiments are starting us to actually access all of these in real measurements. So if you think what is the precursors of this work, or work that is connected to what I'm going to talk about, all related, and I will try to point out the similarities or what are the points in common when I explain the physics that we are seeing. One is the idea, for example, of time crystals. So this one of the first experiments happens at Harvard. And this was leading with NB centers. And also at JQI, entrapped ions. So I think both were published in Nature in 2017. And here, I mean, the commonality, what is the essence of time crystal is that you have new phases that cannot be stable at equilibrium. They don't exist. But moreover, here, interactions are critical to stabilize the time crystal. So these are something that oscillates periodically with its own frequency that is not set by the system parameters. And moreover, that interactions are key to actually maintain this coherence. So this is one of the points that we will see in the cavity system in a slightly different setup. So the other, and actually Shenshua was mentioning a little bit last time, is the idea of a scrambling and quantum chaos. So basically, the idea is that when you let the system evolve, and when you start with a unitary state, a product state, you let it evolve under unitary evolution, and as a function of time, information is spread out into the many body degrees of freedom of the system, and you cannot access the information with local probes. And this idea is connected with this idea of scrambling of quantum information has been tied with the concept of quantum chaos in some degree, and it has postulated, for example, that black holes are the objects that scramble information as fast as possible. And there has been some type of observables that people call OTOX, out of time order correlations, that have been postulated to be a very good proofs for the scrambling of quantum information. So we have been able to measure OTOX for the first time in an experiment at NIST using trapped ions in 2017. So this was in very close collaboration with John's Bollinger group. We published this Bollinger group. We measured this, we published this in Nature Physics. And the connection that I'm going to talk about here is that we're going to implement exactly the same setup but in a cavity QED system. So this work was done in ions, but what I'm going to tell you about is in cavity QED systems, but will lead to similar type of fit to Hamiltonians. Why are these systems so appealing for quantum chaos and for emulating black holes? Because actually, it has been postulated that systems that feature long-range interactions are the ones that have a close similarity with one model that is called the Subir-Jacket IF model. And this model seems to emulate, in some degree, the behavior of black hole. And this Hamiltonian has very long-range interactions, all-to-all interactions with disorder. So I think cavity QED systems can be a good way that we can connect with this type of systems. Mm-hmm. And the last concept that I think is has a lot of connections with other work is the idea of dynamical phase transitions. And here the literature, it's very diverse. So when we submitted the paper, we had a lot of criticism because there is two different type of concepts that people call phase transition. So one concept is in terms of similarities in the what is called on Lord Smith echoes. Mm-hmm. So you have a system, you prepare an initial wave function, you let it evolve as a function of time, you look at the overlap, and if you look at this as a function of time, has some singular behavior. And this is one way that people have defined a dynamical phase transition. And there has been, for example, two experiments that has been seen clear evidence of that experiment. So one was done in Innsbruck, in the Reiner's blood group, in trabions. And the other was done in Hamburg. This was done in Sexton's groups. So this is a PRL. It was in 2017, and this is a Nature Physics in 2018. And this was done with the spin polarized fermions. Fermions in driven lattices. So this is just to say, well, there are these, the people have been interested in this phenomena, but there is another parallel concept that is different. That is when it's more similar to what you understand of phase transitions at equilibrium, that you can connect an order parameter. And then you can see that as you tune an order parameter, there is some singularity, but in this case, it's in the dynamics. So the order parameter, in general, you identify as something that is either a steady state or something that is average over time. And what happens is that this order parameter has some abrupt change of behavior as you change the system parameter. So this is as a function of time. You tune the parameters, and you see that the steady state of the time average have very similar behavior, very very different behavior as a function of time, non-analyticities. And it has this non-analyticity has some specific scaling laws that you can connect with just a characteristic thermodynamics. So you can define even exponents and so forth. And I think here there has been, the recent experiments has been in trap ions too. In this, in the case of Chris Monroe's group, and I think Che Huang was one of the leading theories of this work. So this was in the Ising plus transverse field model, and there has been also some work that we have done in fermions. So also in fermions, and this was done in collaboration with Joseph Thuisen. In Toronto. So this is archive 0.06, 0.04. So here we saw also a dynamical phase transition in a very deep. So here are really frozen particles. These are fermions in a trap, and again we see similar type of dynamics that has a very singular behavior as you turn a parameter. And what I'm just going to tell you is that the cavity QED system has exactly the same physics that I'm going to get done, or very similar physics to all these ingredients in a slightly different setup. And the interesting part is that all these systems here so far are unitary systems. So the new ingredient that the cavity QED is going to bring us is the possibility to explore similar physics, but in an open system. That's the new point. So, okay, so this is kind of the introduction. I mean, a little bit long, but hopefully it motivates you why this kind of work connects with different topics of that is covered by the workshop. That's my interest here. So let's now go to the system at hand, and let me introduce you to our atoms. So Gila is the strontium empire. It has three experiments working with the strontium atoms, and I think there are even intentions to have more. So let me introduce you the type of atoms that we have at Gila and why we care so much about these atoms. So the atoms that we are going to talk about are the alkaline atoms. And we care about these atoms because they have supercoherence. So if you go to the periodic table, then you look at, then you have to look at the atoms here in the second column. So these alkaline atoms have two outer electrons. And for example, strontium is here. This is going to be our atom. There are others with similar structure in the lanthanides, for example, ytterbium here. So there are groups that are also working with ytterbium. So at MIT, Vlad and Buletic has a similar experiment with ytterbium. But here, we are going to work with the strontium. So why people care about these atoms so much? Well, it's because if you look at the atomic structure, they have two very long-lived metastable state. These are referred generally to the clock states. And what are clock states? Well, you can see that this transition from here to here is J equal to 0 to J equal 0, is triplet to singlet. So this transition in principle is forbidden. It's not actually because there is a nuclear spin, but the point is that this is an optical transition, so we are talking about 10 to the 15 hertz, the frequency of this transition. And the lifetime of this atom here, of the atom in excited state, can be as long as millihertz. So it's approximately 2 pi millihertz. So it takes, they have a lifetime that is order of more than 100 seconds, an atom here. So that's why these type of systems are ideal for clocks, and the best clock in the world now operates with alkaline atoms. Just to give you an example that I always like to give because it's amazing how impressive are these atoms. If you think as an atom as a pendulum and you want to characterize how good a pendulum is, you always refer to the quality factor, that is the ticking rate divided by the damping. So the ticking rate divided by the lifetime of this. Mm-hmm. And think if you put this number for strontium atoms, you get that is larger than 10 to the 17. That means if you do the analog to a classical system, it's a pendulum that when you set, if you set it to swing, it would swing for the entire edge of the universe. That's how good is this atom, and that's why it has been impressive for clocks. I mean, the sensitivity are 10 to the minus 18, and Juni is trying to push it to 10 to the minus 19 now. So it's amazing atom, and what we want to use this atom is for probing many body physics because we have very long time to interrogate that. So let me now I'm talking about a cavity in cavity QED systems. So what are the implications that these type of atoms have for a cavity? Well, it's so interesting because it opens a new regime in cavity QED that people have not explored before. In most of the other implementations that people had before, the lifetime of the cavity, so was the one that was, so the transitions are megahertz transitions, dipolar out transition, so they decay much faster than the cavity. We are going to reverse completely the roles, and now the cavity is the one that decays much faster compared with atomic transition. And this brings us to a new regime in cavity QED that we start to store. So the story today is about how this new regime opens new physics. Mm-hmm. So yes, so let's go back to my cavity now. Let's put these strontium atoms in a cavity. And well, when you have a cavity, you are going to characterize the dynamics by, so you have your mirrors, and you have, we trap the atoms in a 1D lattice to trap them tightly. We have atoms here, so and then for the parameters of the cavity, you have, well, the decay rate kappa of the cavity. Mm-hmm. And typical cavity decay rates are the order of 100 kilohertz. These are typical good cavities in general. But now, if you think about our atom, so again, 1 is 0, 3 is 0, this decay at gamma, that is 2 pi millihertz. So you see that the cavity decays 9 orders of magnitude faster than the atoms. So that's completely different. And the other parameter that is very important for the student, the cavity dynamic, is the tuning of the cavity. So this is the tuning of the cavity compared to the atomic transition. So we're going to define a parameter delta that is omega zero minus omega critical of the cavity. This is the tuning of the cavity. So if we're going to write the Hamiltonian that determines the dynamics of these atoms in the cavity, and for simplicity, I'm going to assume that, of course, we are trapping the atoms. So the assumption is that the cavity, the wavelength of the lattice that traps the atoms is commensurate with the wavelength of the cavity. It's not exactly that in the experiment, but for simplicity, let me assume that. So in that case, the Hamiltonian that determines the physics is the tuning of the cavity from the transition. This is delta. And then the standard James Comey Hamiltonian, where G is the single particle Rabi frequency. And then the interesting part is that if this is commensurate, then it talks to all the atoms at the same time. I'm going to assume that we have a two-level system, and therefore I'm going to define collective operators like X, Y, and Z that are the sum over individual spins. So X, Y, I, Z, I. So most of the times in this talk, not all, I'm going to operate in this what is called the Dickey regime, when we are having the eigenvalue of this collective operator J squared, it's n half. In this case, we are going to associate it with n half plus one, for example. That is the maximally symmetric manifold, the Dickey manifold. That's what we want to operate in many cases. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the elastic part of the Hamiltonian. We have this single particle Rabi coupling. A is the operator that creates or destroys a photon in the cavity. Then we have, however, an open system, because then, as I said, this decay is very important. It's the largest energy scale. So kappa for our system.
Given that here you have now as main frequency the detuning, right, which is relatively small, and now you have J on a collective,
this one? Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is proportional to M, that can be large. Why can I then assume that you don't have counter-rotating contributions?
Because it's an optical transition. It's an optical transition.
Yeah, but delta is not.
Delta can be delta. What we are talking also is the difference between this cavity to the cavity. this can be, I mean, you can be, it's much larger than, I mean, you.
It's still large.
Yes, yes. Right. Yes, I mean, this is in optical transition, this is a very good approximation. When you have microwaves or something, that's where you are not. But here we are really in an optical transition where this is a very good approximation. So, yes, so this.
Let's say the getting puny, because now the optical transition, let's say, you've shifted to a situation where the frequency that's going to matter is.
Yes. So remember, omega plus omega, this is terahertz. This is 10 to the 15. It's oscillating very quickly. So what I'm going to. So the contra rotating term is going to have this term.
Yeah, no, I think I'm getting confused because I would argue that. The picture where you would be making now, the description would be rotating in such a way that the thing that matters is the decumulative,
yes.
Not omega naught, but
there is the omega the transition of the atomic transition, and then the transition of the cavity. Yes? So we are going to have delta, that is the difference between the two, and the other term that would come is the one with the plus. Yes. This term is rotating at 10 to the 15 hertz. Much larger than any other energy scale in our system. All the energy, other energy scales are 100 of kilohertz or something. So it's really, this is why in optical transitions, this rotating wave approximation is so nice. So yeah, so 10 to the 15 is very, very fast. So yeah, so we have the detuning here. And then, but what we can do, I mean, what is interesting here in our system is that kappa is much larger than gamma, the decay rate, and much larger than G. So in this case, what happens is that I can adiabatically eliminate my photons. Basically, photons are leaking so fast that I can adiabatically eliminate the photon mode and try slave the photon mode to the spin operator. So for the photon, I will have just the characteristic the photons are leaking in a very fast way. So then this will have the Markovian term that is associated with the losses, with a loss rate kappa, and this is the anticommutator. Yes, this is characteristic Markovian dynamics with a jump operator that is associated with A. This is the decay of the cavity.
Sorry, You don't have any pumping of the cavity.
I'm not going to pump the cavity, I'm going to pump later. But that's the beauty of these systems.
Because this would have a potential in this person.
Yes, yes, exactly. I'm not going to pump the cavity, and the reason why I don't need to pumping is because the excited state is so long-lived that as long as I prepare some inversion, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have these two terms. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to adiabatically eliminate the cavity field because it decays so fast. And therefore, there is the important relationship between A, that is really going to be a slave to the atomic coherence. So there is one-to-one correspondence between A and J minus, and this is going to be key for the observations. All right, so if I do that, and then I plug it back and I write an effective Hamiltonian for the spins, that is what I care about, then the effective Hamiltonian of the spins are going to have two terms associated with elastic and inelastic interactions. So if I'm now going to put back my Hamiltonian, then I have a Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian part, that is the elastic term, this is the Hamiltonian part. And then I have a dissipated part that I can associate with a jump operator, A, that is a square root of gamma J minus. Remember, I mean, it's natural because A is a slave to J minus. And this parameter gamma, so let me call this parameter chi, and this parameter gamma is associated G squared kappa divided kappa half squared plus delta squared. So you can see, if there is, in principle, this elastic part is associated with the elastic part of with the detuning, And then this inelastic part is directly proportional to kappa, that is the cavity loss. So these are the two. The interesting part is here, is that it's collective dissipation. So this is something that is going to be very interesting and important for actually experimental observing what is going on. So with this type of Hamiltonian, this real part and the imaginary part, our first task was trying to see if we could observe manifestation of these two terms in an experiment.
Sorry to interrupt again. You are working with an effective Hamiltonian, not with the full Lindblad.
The full Lindblad. So I have now I have the dynamics of the density matrix that is going to be the commutator of this, and plus this, where I have.
This is the renormalized jump operator.
Exactly. These are the renormalized jump operators that are collective. And I want to see manifestation of each of those terms in my experiment. Mm-hmm. So the simplest way to see this term is what gives rise to what is called supervariance. And this term could give me exchange interactions. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of how we're observing the experiment. So let's start with the supervariance, that is very easy. So supervariance means that instead of a collective decay of the system, and it was postulated years ago by Dicke in the 50s, where you have all the atoms decay together. So superradiance. And this experiment was published in Science Advance in 2016. So what is that, what is interesting here? The interesting here is that, you see, if we look at this parameter here, imagine that we set kappa delta equal to 0, for simplicity. We are on resonance. So kappa, this gamma is g squared, is proportional to 4g squared divided by kappa, mm-hmm. This parameter here. Mm-hmm. And this is associated with something that is called the cooperativity. You multiply by the decay rate and multiply by decay rate. This is what is called cooperativity in the cavity. And this single particle cooperativity in the experiment is not that large. It's 0.4. Mm-hmm. So it's a very it's not in the strongly interacting limit. And this gamma is very small. This gamma is the order of millihertz. So in principle, if we want to see the decay of this atom, it would take more than 100 of seconds, almost 1 hour, to see the decay. But what is the beauty? The beauty is that in the experiment, they can trap 10 to the 5 atoms or more. And then the idea of you have a collective decay means that you are going to replace this decay rate of a single atom by something that decays n times faster. And the power, if the power of n atoms is going to be n gamma, then you are going to replace it by n squared gamma. So then the scales that are so low then becomes of the order of 40 hertz or something that you can see in the experiment very nicely. It's very convenient to see in the experiment. And actually that's what they saw. So in the experiment, what they did is that basically, if you look at this is my block sphere. What they did is that they prepared all the atoms in the excited state of the cavity. So they apply a very strong pulse initially, and then let the system evolve. So, and then measure the output out of the cavity. You have the cavity, and then they measure. Here they have a detector that measures the photons that are output of the cavity. Mm-hmm. And they can measure the power or the emission. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that, remember, this emission, the photon, is a slave to J minus. So you prepare all the atoms in the excited state. You might think there is nothing happens because you don't have coherences. But however, because there is noise, intrinsic noise in your system, quantum mechanical noise, then it's going to drive a little bit. You are going to start rotating. This drives the superradiant emissions. Then you are going to go to the equator when the coherence is maximum and you have a burst. And then as you go down, then your superradiant emission stops. So exactly that is the behavior that I observe in the experiment. So it's the output power. And what they see is nothing because it's triggered by this noise. The noise they get effective, and then you get, as you go to the equator, you get this high peak, and then they decay because, well, there is nothing that feeding the system. And what C is that this power, so for example, this is 200 K atoms, and then you have a reduction on a factor of 4, for example, if you use 100 K. And this happens at time scales of the order of 100 seconds, 400 seconds, milliseconds, that is really accessible in the experiment.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt you again, because this is one of my long-term PhD periods. Do you observe large fluctuations in the peak from one experiment to the other?
Yes, well, in principle, they could observe, but I mean, this is the average. This is what I'm
saying. The average, yes. Yes, but if you run a single experiment, the time at which this peak emission takes place fluctuates strongly from one to the other.
Yes.
Do they observe it?
Yes, I think so. I think so, yes. I think the time of the is log n. There is some fluctuations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, so yes. Everything, this is very, it's a very simple model. We can emulate it perfectly, and everything is consistent with the experiment and the theory. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of simple physics, showing that we have the ingredients. Mm-hmm. So let me now tell you is how is the interplay between the two, because what we want to see is the interplay between elastic and inelastic effects. Mm-hmm. So now let's go to the other term in the Hamiltonian, that is the exchange. So this is kind of the exchange interaction, and you have here exchange in many contexts, and perhaps the most familiar case is in dipolar interactions, in helium atom. Basically, the exchange is that if you have two particles, two atoms, so atom 1 and atom 2, and you have one atom in the excited state, for example, it can go back to the down to the ground state. This can emit a photon, and then an atom in the ground state absorb the photons and flip. So basically, this term is kind of the collective version of something that is Ji plus, Jj minus, and sum over Ij. So it's these flip-flop processes. And these flip-flop processes have been seen in different experiments, have been seen in polar molecules, in Rydberg atoms, in trap ions, and recently in cavities. But this has been seen in cavities only very recently. So we saw it for the first time last year. And this year, there was an experiment in Stanford with Smith. Well, he saw exchange interactions in 2018 in a cavity also with Raman transition, PRL. So this is very recent. I mean, in this case, the interactions were also collective, but she saw some. Some locality in the experiment, the way that she was probing that. So let me tell you a little bit how we probe this exchange interaction in our system. Mm-hmm. So the interesting part is that because we are talking about a collective system, mm-hmm, J plus J minus, this Hamiltonian can be written as much simpler Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian can be written as chi J squared minus JC squared, like that. So the interesting part is that this term, I'm going to refer it as gap protection. And this is, for example, the one that I'm going to say disconnects with time crystals. And this thing, this term is called one-axis twisting, and this is what is going to give me entanglement in the system, in principle.
It's like leaking light kind of understanding.
It's leaking without a transverse.
Without a transverse.
Yes, exactly. If I add this, that is going to be the next step. This is what we are working now in the experiment. So, let me just first ignore this and see what is the physics that we expect to see. So, we divide the physics in two, in these terms. So, one axis twisting. So let me tell you what are the two experiments that we did to identify these two terms. First, let me talk about the one-axis twisting. interestingly, these two terms commute, yes? So if you are in the decay manifold, so you are in the state with all the particles are fully symmetric, so when j is equal to n half, then you are going to remain in this manifold because there is nothing that kicks you out of the manifold. This is a constant of motion, and therefore the dynamics is only driven by this term. That's it. Mm-hmm. And for condensed matter theories, this term might be the simplest boring term that you can ever imagine, a collectivizing interaction, very simple. But interestingly, this term can give you squeezing and can give you entanglement. So how we did, how we probe this term? So the way that we probe this term was first by looking at the mean field. Imagine that if you have a term that is chi jc squared. At the mean field, what you would say is that your mean field Hamiltonian is approximately 2 chi expectation value of jc times jc. And I'm just factorizing this term. Mm-hmm. So what it's giving me is that I have an effective magnetic field that depends on the inversion. Mm-hmm. And because this inversion is a constant of motion during the dynamics, what it just gives at the mean field is a net precession. So if I look, if I solve the dynamics for j minus as a function of time, it's going to be j minus as 0 e to the I, and let me call this h bar omega, one axis twisting. So this is going to rotate like omega OIT. Very simple. So what I'm going to see is that if I have this Hamiltonian, then I'm going to see precession at a rate that depends on the inversion of the system. And I can control the inversion in the experiment by a first pulse. So I start with all the particles. So what we did in the experiment is that we start with all particles down. We start with all particles down, and then we apply a pulse that drives by driving the cavity. Mm-hmm. Then we let the system evolve, and then there is going to be a precession at a rate that depends on the inversion. And then how I'm going to detect this precession? I'm going to detect this precession because I'm going to look at the cavity, at the light that is leaking from the cavity, and I'm going to do an iterodyne measurement by comparing with a very stable oscillation. So by this iterodyne measuring, I can measure the phase of the light that is coming out of the cavity. And remember that because A is a slide with J minus, then the phase of the light is going to tell me the phase of my coherence. And that's exactly what we observe. So when we do the iterodyne detection, what we are going to, there are two different experiments that we did. One experiment is that we fix the inversion. So we set the initial drive to be fixed, and what we did is we varied the detuning. And what we varied the detuning, we see the characteristic. So remember that the term that is proportional to this is chi. And chi, remember, that was proportional to delta squared plus kappa squared. This was, chi was proportional to this. So we saw this very nice dispersion light fissure as a function of delta, and this is the phase of the cavity. So it reveals that as we tune and we change even the sign of the detuning, it inverts the rotation precession. That was the first observation. The second observation, we look also at the phase for fixed delta. Then what we saw is a straight line as a function. This is for as a function of the inversion, normalized inversion. And we see that it goes from minus 0.5 to 0.5. And you saw this straight line that it tells me the effect of this one axis twist. So that's very simple. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the first observations. Well, we have this term. It's at the mean field level, but we have it. So let me now see the effect of this other term. So we have, remember the invariant Hamiltonian, you have J squared minus JC squared. So how we detected J squared? So any ideas of how you would detect this J squared? So we have a Hamiltonian that is chi J squared minus JC squared. So we know that if we prepare the Hamiltonian in the Dicke manifold and we only have this Hamiltonian, this is a constant. So what we need is to add some terms in the system that actually modify this, makes it not a constant. So one of the simplest ways that we can add in the experiment is that add something that is non-local. So this Hamiltonian is inhomogeneous. Some is some defacing, some type of defacing, and then very quickly it's going to actually, these two terms are no longer commuting, and then they're going to compete. Mm-hmm. So what is the simplest way to see the competition? And why this term can be very important? If you have, imagine that you only have JC squared and this term. Imagine that you only have this term. Then what happens is that if you remember that we have different manifolds, we have J equal to n half, this is the Dicke manifold, J equal to n half minus 1, J to n half minus 2, and so forth, until you get J equal to 0. That's all the possible Hilbert space that you have at hand. So if you have this term, and you prepare all your particles here, then there is nothing that this term is connecting this with this. Because, I mean, the variance, this is proportional to the variance of this edge. So if you start here, there is a matrix element that are going to lead you from here to here. And then there is going to be a matrix element that leads you from here to here, from here to here, until to here to here. And you're completely going to deface. Completely. Very bad. So if that's one scenario when you don't have this term. But you can see that the physics completely changes when you start to add this term. Because this term adds a gap that's called the exchange gap. So with chi j squared, then you can see that you have your j equal to a half manifold, but it's separated by the gap that is proportional to chi n. It's huge gap, it scales with n from the state that has j equal to n half minus 1. So now you're going to add this defacing here, and the story is going to change because it's going to be something that is going to be suppressing the decoherence that is causing this term. So if this variance is small compared to this gap, then if you start here, you're going to remain here and you're not going to deface. So this is what we call gap protection, and this is, for example, very similar physics. Can be thought when you have these time crystals that you were locking the spins. It's exactly the same physics. So this gap can be very useful at the moment when we want to generate, for example, spin squeezing. So we wanted to measure that in the experiment. And the way that we perform a measurement of the gap in the experiment was trying to do a refacing-defacing protocol. So this is the idea, and in order to measure that in the experiment, we did the following protocol. The point is that for the experimentalists, it's very easy to add this term. And they can change the sign. They can even reverse the sign by changing some detuning. So they can make it positive or negative. So in the experiment, the way that they measure that, we measure that, was the following sequence. Prepare an state. Then actually do apply this defacing. Let it evolve for time t hold, and then undo the dynamics. So now you are going to do minus si sigma ci with the opposite sign, and then measure the accumulated phase. So let me consider the case where here the Hamiltonian is just chi jc squared.
How is that term entered experimentally?
This term here is just starships. So when you have, you can have them. If you are not magic, so in principle, the lattice, the potential, the external potential that is filled by the ground and excited atoms, the lattice is designed such that they fill the same potential with a specific wavelength that is called magic wavelength. But if you apply any other wavelength, they have different polarizabilities. So they're going to feel different on-site, like starships. And they, by changing the tuning from positive to negative, you can put make this starship positive or negative. So it's just applying a laser that generates a starship, and then it's easy to turn off, on, and change the sign. Mm-hmm. So that's why turning on and off that was very trivial, very fast. Let it evolve and undo. So the point is that if you have Hamiltonian that is like that, because this commute is like not applying anything, because you do the dynamics, then apply this term, this apply this term, but they are in the same basis, they commute. So it's actually, if we have this term, then it's actually kind of equivalent to have JC squared. So the nothing happens if you apply this. But now what happens when you have the chi J squared? I want to explain in the simplest way possible, so let me just consider two atoms and the physics holds you have made. If you have two atoms, you can form singlet and triplets, that the eigenstate of this J squared Hamiltonian. Yes? So you have a triplet manifold, that is the J equal to 1, and you have a singlet manifold, that is the J equal to 0, and because this is proportional to J squared, there is an energy difference between these two that is proportional to chi in this case. Okay. So the idea is the following. I prepare a state along the x direction in the Dicke manifold. So I'm going to have atoms here, here, and here. That's my initial state. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to decohere the system. And when I decohere the system, because this conserves C, then this is the only one that can be affected by this Hamiltonian. And actually, because it's completely random, I'm going to transfer my atoms from here to here. So that's why this pulse does transfer from this system from the triplet to the singlet. But now, because there is a different phase between these two, the singlet is going to acquire a phase that is due to the 2 chi during the holding time t. Mm-hmm. And then after this protocol, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put my singlet back into the triplet. And therefore, this state is going to have this phase that is different compared to these neighbors, the states that are minus 1, 1, and 0, and this, because this will not accumulate a phase. Mm-hmm. Moreover, because I have this other Hamiltonian, if I have not only this, but I can have k squared minus jc squared, what happens is that from this term, I also accumulate a phase, because the m equal to 0, and the m equal to minus 1 and 1 have different jc's. So from this term, I also accumulate a phase that is 2 chi t, the same. You can work it out. It's exactly the same, the phase from this jc square and from this j square. And because there is a minus sign, the phase completely cancels. So what did the experiment see? The experiment see is that if it doesn't do anything, if you doesn't do the defacing or the refacing, then we accumulate, as a function of t hole, the phase that accumulate is going to be linear with time, mm-hmm. because it's the one-axis twisting dynamic. But if they apply these two, doing and undoing, then there is no phase. You see the phase canceled here. There was no phase observed. And this difference is associated to chi t, that is the gap. So by measuring the slope of this, we measure the gap. And it's exactly 2 chi. So that was one of the observations that we were able to see. Well, we have the two terms in the dynamics. Mm-hmm. So it's really an exchange Hamiltonian. And even though it's a simple experiment, it's kind of the first steps toward quantum simulation, because you have to show that you have exactly the Hamiltonian that you want. Mm-hmm. I was telling you about the spin squeezing, and the bad news that we have is that we never observe it. in that type of experiments, because what I have been telling you is the elastic dynamics, but I have before I told you about the super radiance, and actually these two compete very badly. And what happened is that when you have both and you try to see what happens with the squeezing, it's really bad. So you do the theory. So I don't know, are you familiar with the spin squeezing or not too much? Or should I give a, well, maybe I will give a brief introduction of, so.
Can I ask you a question still about this?
Yes.
So if you had the same HIs everywhere, nothing would happen?
Nothing would happen, yes.
So there must be some relation between how much happens and what's the dispersion.
Perfect, yeah. And what we did is to make it completely random. Yes, fully agree. Exactly. Okay. Yes, so only when you have fully random, you go a perfect transfer to the sink. Otherwise, you don't do that, the perfect transfer. Yes.
But the size of dispersion.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes, yes. That was a very important point, and that's why we have to make sure that these phases were completely random. So yes. And if it's not completely random, then you can do the math, and you can see, yes, it's not exactly to cut. Mm-hmm. Good point. Mm-hmm. Yes, any more question about this? So I want, Elia, so... I'm going to tell you now, we are going to move on the quantum part that is the squeezing, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about these dynamical phase transitions and the magic that we can generate in principle spin squeezing from the environment. That's the next part of the talk. So first the bad news. The bad news is that if I have my Hamiltonian like I was mentioning before, so if we have just the Hamiltonian that is chi j plus j minus, and the jump operator that is for a that is proportional to square root of gamma j minus. Then, well, from this Hamiltonian that I can write it like this, let me tell you a little bit of spin squeezing. Spin squeezing happens because imagine that I prepare a state that is pointing along x. So x is in this direction out of the blackboard, and therefore this is z and y. So if I have a coherent state, so if I have an expectation value of sx equal to n half, then you know that the variance of sx is equal to 0, but the variance of sy is equal to the variance of sz squared, that is n divided by 4. Quite noisy, very noisy along the it's so we have a very noisy system with a variance that is proportional to n. So now I prepare this initial state and I let it evolve with this Hamiltonian. So you can see from the prior picture that the effective Hamiltonian was kind of two expectation value of Jc, chi, Jc. You can see that the part of the noise in the north is going to rotate in opposite direction than the part of the noise in the south pole. So these are going to move in this direction, and these are going to rotate in this opposite direction, and it's going to twist your noise and generate at some point something that actually is going to be kind of distorted. So at some point you're going to have something like this spin squeeze. It's going to be narrow in one direction and more, and this direction is very good for measuring, and then it's going to be is going to be larger in the other direction. And that allows to introduce a parameter that is called spin squeezing, that the spin squeezing parameter is going to be proportional to square root of n, the minimal variance along one direction, divided by the length of your spin. This spin squeezing parameter, the interesting part is that this parameter is smaller than 1, is an entanglement witness. If it's larger than 1, you cannot say anything, but if it's smaller than 1, then you have entanglement in your system. So the interesting part is that this Hamiltonian generates spin squeezing, and generates spin squeezing that can be significant. So for example, if you look at the spin squeezing as a function of the particle number, the spin squeezing here in dBs, as a function of the particle number, you can see that it actually increases. This is a log scale. It increases like, but it goes like n to the 2/3. is not, doesn't give you the Heisenberg limit that was 1 over n, but it gives you a minus 2 thirds. But it gives you some significant amount of spin squeezing this Hamiltonian JC squared. But however, now you add this super radiance in the dynamics, something that is decoherent and want to bring you down to the South Pole, then you start here very quickly, you are going to saturate and just get very tiny squeezing as a function of the particle number. So it's really bad. I mean, this super radiance can be a killer if you want to generate the spin squeezing during the dynamics. So what I'm going to tell you now is how we are planning to fix this issue.
I have a question. So the spin squeezing, the time needed to obtain the optimal spin squeezing also decreases with the number, right? Does that actually beat this sort of collective decay rate, or which one is faster?
Well, the point is that you have, you can set up the pencil, it's true. So there are parameters, I mean, you are making a good point that this chi is proportional to this, and this gamma is proportional to this. So it's true that the ratio between chi and gamma is proportional to delta divided by kappa. So in principle, if you make delta huge, then you are not going to be that bad. You are not suffer that bad with respect to the spin squeezing, to kappa. But the problem is that if you make delta huge, then this term becomes very small, and then the other source of decoherence kill you in your experiment. So you were in the ideal world that nothing happens, and you are able to tune kappa delta to be huge compared to the kappa, then you would get some spin squeezing. So this picture that I'm telling you is for fixed kappa over gamma. So this is, for example, when it's 0.1 or something. Even very small values of that. I mean, yes, if you tune it and try to wait forever, that would not happen. But this is for fixed resources. So that's the problem. So what we want to generate is something that in the experimental realistic time scales, we can generate the spin squeezing and see some interesting phase transitions, for example. So next part of my talk is trying to tell you a little bit our efforts to generate the spin squeezing to actually use this term that is bad as a resource. That's what we want to use. And actually, the solution is quite simple, that is to drive the cavity. So before, what happens is that we let the system evolve, and then super radiance brings everything down. So the next step in order to bring spin squeezing is try to see how we drive the cavity and generate.
Sorry, one question. Mm-hmm. What you describe is analogous to trying to perform in interferometry or metrology, preparing GNSS states and being subject to completely
well in the
ambient phase, right?
Yes.
The inclusion now of driving, essentially, another way to see it is that you will modify the structure of the inlet operators, right?
Exactly. So actually, the JC square Hamiltonian generate cat states too. So then, at the beginning, so if you do like the dynamics of JC square Hamiltonian, if you look, for example, the expectation of Sx, you start maximally polarized, your coherence decay, and then go back because it's a fully integral model. And here at the middle of this revival, so this revival is proportional to, this proportion is when chi t is equal to 2 pi, revival. Mm-hmm. At this, you generate a cat state. But if you have the coherence, it's going to decay like e to the minus gamma nt. So this is terrible.
What I mean is that by now, given the structure of the Hamiltonian and the structure of the Euclideans, it's fully characterized the type of limits that you can get asymptotically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And even the ones you may error correct and so on.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And actually, the beauty is that I can even get analytic solutions of this system. I can tell you exactly what is the steady state that you get. Yes, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yes, so let me tell you. So the recipe is drive your cavity. And in the context of the spin model, because remember that the cavity photons are leaking very fast, driving the cavity is equivalent as introducing a Hamiltonian omega jx. That's it. So our Hamiltonian is going to be replaced from j plus j minus to omega jx. Very trivial change. And then let's see what is the physics that we get by introducing the system. First, in contrast to when you, in the absence of this term, everything trivially relaxes to the solved pole because that's the effect of super radiance. You start here, you relax. Now you don't, or there is a competition between this gamma and the kappa. So this dates back, our idea, this idea is not new, and even in the 18th, people were trying to think about this direction. So you have the papers by Carmichael. This is a neurophysics B in the 1980s. And what he refers this phenomena as cooperative resonance fluorescence. And he considered the case when this is zero. So he said, let me put high time to zero. No elastic interaction, just let's compute what is the effect of this term and the jump operator that is square root of gamma j minus. This jump operator. What is the competition between these two? And actually, it's interesting. I don't know. I love it when there is a system that has an analytic solution. Carmichael shows that if you are going to try to compute the steady state, so of your Lieblin master equation solution, actually there is an analytic form that is beautiful obtained by doing first you do the following. You have your j plus operator and you replace j plus by j plus minus alpha the identity. So you shift your operator and you set with alpha just given by this the ratio between omega and chi. When you shift your operator, you plug it back in your master equation, you get a solution that is very trivial. You get that the exact solution of the density matrix of the steady state is just a steady state is proportional to one, what we call this tilde. So that if I this tilde, when I displace my operator, this tilde is going to be j minus tilde j plus. This is the density matrix that gives you the steady state. Very simple, beautiful solution. And with that, just putting this and trying to compute dynamics, you find that there is a true dynamical phase transition in the system. So let me tell you what he finds. So if you put this exact solution, then he finds that there is an order parameter in the steady state. Now we're looking at the steady state, that is the inversion. The inversion in the steady state. And what he finds is that the inversion of the steady state has a behavior. There is one omega divided by omega critical. Omega critical is n gamma divided by 2. And what he finds is that there is a second order phase transition at omega critical, where here the inversion is finite. So this is minus 1. So this is when omega critical is zero, you always relax to the steady state. So this is the normalized. And then as a function of time, and this is zero. So you go being from down to the south pole, and then at some point, at the critical point, you go down, and then you have zero inversion as a function of time. Very similar to the one that in the Ising plus transverse field model, but this is different because this is in the steady state. So it doesn't matter of the initial condition. It's just really a robust property of the system. You put the system, you let it evolve, and that's the characteristics independent of how you start.
So maybe I've asked you this question before. So at the critical point, does the time it takes to convert to the steady state also diverges?
Yeah, I will go into this. Yes, there is a critical slow in that, but we have tricks to avoid that in principle, yes. So yes, so this is the phase transition that you get when you have kappa chi equal to zero. So there is a critical point. So our first task was trying to see what happens if I'm going to start to add elastic interactions. So you might imagine that elastic interactions are going to drastically affect the dynamics. And the answer is going to be yes, but in a very non-trivial way. So when I ask my student, let's try to generalize this, and at high, actually he finds very nicely that everything holds. So, but you just have to add here, instead of having this, you are going to add minus, this is a factor of 4, minus 2, 2i chi. So if you do this transformation, everything holds exactly, no difference. So in the steady state, chi only regularizes the transition. So here, so let me say maybe the transition here was characterized by JC having two different behaviors. So here JC was 1 minus omega divided by omega critical square, or omega divided by omega critical smaller than 1, and 0 for omega critical larger than 1. This is the dynamical phase transition. To add chi, and the only thing that changes is that omega critical changes to a square root of, well, the same half, a square root of gamma squared plus 4 kappa squared. That's the only difference. So it just regularizes the transition and shifts it. So basically, if I plot the phase diagram, so I can now have a two-axis plot of the transition. Now I put 2 chi divided by gamma, and I'm going to have here 2 omega divided by n gamma. So remember that when this was 1, was the phase transition for chi equal to 0? So let me draw this. So in this region, on this region, we call it super value. And on this region, we have normal. And this super radian means that in the steady state, you have finite inversion. The absolute value is equal is larger than 0. Whereas here in the steady state, JC in the steady state is 0. That's the phase diagram. And this line is this. Omega critical, gamma, n half, plus this term. So everything the same, just are really just renormalizing the critical point, nothing different. The characteristic of the transition, everything identical. So that was surprising for me. And then, well, of course, we need to understand the physics, so I asked him to solve the dynamics at the mean field level and see what we get. I mean, let's do the simplest treatment, like this is exact solution. And then I asked him, okay, can you solve the dynamics assuming just the simple factorization that J alpha, J beta is going to be proportional to J alpha, J beta mean field? Like, you assume that everything is factorizable and try to solve this nonlinear set of questions. And he did it, and he told me, well, actually, mean field is wrong. Mean field doesn't give me that. And I said, how can it be? Yes, mean field doesn't give me that. Mean field give me first a first order transition, and second, everything that I see in this region. Remember, this is the transition from 0 chi, and this is the transition from the steady state. Everything in this region is different. This is the same. In this super radian is the same. Here, the normal is the same. But here, I get something different. And I get a first-order transition that I don't see in the exact solution. So we started to analyze a little bit what is going on. And, I mean, the story that I'm going to tell you is that actually, mean field is correct in the sense that this steady state that we are seeing here, surprisingly, it happens at very long time scales that would never be accessing the experiment. And that, in fact, what the experiment is seeing is a first-order phase transition, not a second-order phase transition. But unless you are, but in principle, only if you are able to wait very long time, then you will see the first one, the exact solution. So there is a very long pre-thermalization behavior that is present in the system, and just to connect to squeezing, what I'm going to, in the interesting part, is that if you look at the spin squeezing in the steady state, what you find is that the spin squeezing is huge here, very close to this critical point. So if you look at the characteristics of the steady state, even when you have no interactions, just the competition between a drive and super radiance, then you have that there is a highly explicit state. So if you were able to wait forever, then you are going to get an exquisite state in your system. However, things are complicated because reaching the steady state takes time. So there are some tweaks that you need to do in order to tell the system to go here without taking forever. So this is the part that I'm going to elaborate a little bit more. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the mean field phase diagram, the surprises that we got, and if I have time, I'm going to tell you what is the trick that we are going to use in the experiment to try to go here, one thing. And second, I'm going to report very preliminary experimental data that sees the dynamical phase transition in the system. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go to the mean field solution.
Are you going also to explain what forever is? Are you going to explain what forever is?
I'm going to explain you forever is. And actually, yes, forever, unfortunately, is gamma. So the point is that everything that is collective has time scales n gamma that is accessible for us. But if things lose the factor of n and I only have gamma, then it means 1 hour in my system and I cannot reach it. But yes, I'm going to show you. Okay, so what I'm going to do is that, okay, so let's see, I'm going to fix in this phase diagram, I'm going to cut a line here, and this is going to, I'm going to put it here, this line as a, and this is going to be for fix gamma, a chi divided by gamma, so fix. And then in this line, I'm going to identify these regimes. This from here to here is what I call super radiance. And then this part here, if I have color, hopefully, well, green, purple. So this part, that is the part that is disappearing between mean field and the exact solution, I call you metastable in this region. So this is the critical point in the steady state. It's omega critical. This is as a function of omega, yes. So this line is omega. And then here is omega critical from the steady state. And this is the normal, so this is super radiant. This is normal. And what I'm going to tell you is what happens in a set of points here. I'm going to put the points, let me see exactly what I'm going to. So this is point, yeah, a little bit more here. I'm going to put a point A here, a point B here, a point C here. I'm going to divide this here. So this is the critical. I'm going to tell you that there is another critical point at the mean field that let me call omega tilde. Here, in this weird region, this is metastable region, there is going to be a first order phase transition that is not the same here. So I'm going to be in a point here, A, before the phase transition B, after this first order phase transition D, before this critical point here, and after the critical point. So that's the regions that I want to have. Just before and after the steady state critical point, just before and after a new phase transition that appears at mean field, and just far from it. Let me try to show you the behavior. So let's start with point A. So point A, and let me tell you what we see. So the order parameter is the inversion as a function of time. And in all these cases, we are going to start in the south one, when this normalized quantity is minus 1. So what we find at the mean field level is that in this intermediate region, the dynamics strongly depends on the initial conditions. So if I'm going to plot the initial conditions. This is the initial conditions, and I'm going to plot the projection of my block sphere in the xy plane. So this is expectation value of jy initial, jx initial. Mm-hmm. Then you have this block sphere, generalized block sphere here. If, for example, I'm going to start at the south pole, so I'm going to start here. But what happens is that this, there is a, this is the super radian. This is the normal phase. And there is this new boundary. And this new boundary is the new critical point that appears. And this critical point that appears is going to depend on omega. So here in this point, I'm here in this point A, and this is the phase diagram that I find. So for the point, for this fixed A, I find a region where everything is super radiant from this condition, a region when there is normal, and for example, in that case, for this parameter A, my initial point that starts in the south pole is in the super radiant region. So the dynamics that I see is that something like this. I start like this, then I go like that, and very quickly saturate to a steady state that is fine. This is JC. An interesting mean field and exact solution match exactly one into each other. I don't see any difference between the exact and the mean field. And both has a fine, and this is the steady state that the exact solution predicts, very well characterized by the mean field. So this is point A. I mean, it's good because according to the general phase diagram, I am going to be in this region, so everything is perfect. Okay. Now let me try to start approaching this point. So what happens is that if I solve the mean field equations for the parameter omega that is in point B, what happens is that these initial conditions are shifted, and then this line is moved. And then I'm here. So here I am still in the super radiant phase. That's why I have been, this is in the super radiant, not in the normal phase. But and then what I start to see is that still, because I'm in the super radiant phase, then the exact, so it start to, it the new plot is a little bit, it start here, but it goes a little bit upper. Like the dynamics is going to go like here, a little bit upper, and saturates at a little bit higher value, close to zero, but nothing very different. So the exact solution does something like that, differentiate a little bit here, but the exact solution also matches this the mean field. So you see the deviation as you start to approach this super, this critical point from this side, but nothing, only minor. Mm-hmm. So now let me put here myself. Now I'm in the normal phase from the mean field. So that means if I solve the mean field phase diagram, what I think is that my point is, instead of being here, for all these initial conditions, I am super radiant, but all of these below, I'm normal. So now, according to the mean field, I'm in the normal phase, but according to the exact solution, I'm not. So this is the dynamics, what happens. So the mean field, according to the mean field, I'm in the normal phase. So the mean field starts to do these very weird excursions. This is mean field. It's non-linear, so this is some oscillations that are kind of non-linear. This is mean field. So my mean field oscillates, and this is the normal phase. On average, I get zero inversion. And the exact solution, what it does is that follows the mean field here, goes a little bit up above the south pole, above the equator. It starts in and then it starts to dump and decay to a finite value of Z. So, of course, in the exact solution, the steady state is still in the super radiant phase, so it has to get finite value of magnetization. And then you see a strong deviation because the mean field starts to oscillate. So this is one of the differences. But you can see, nevertheless, the exact solution does go above the equator. So one of the symptoms is that something weird is happening. Now, you are, and I'm here in this critical point. Let's see what happens. I start to approach the real critical point in the steady state. Mm-hmm. Here is where everything starts to be very slow. And I'm going to put, I forgot, so as a function of in units of gamma t, this is of the order of 0.1 or something, 0.1, 0.5, something like that. Mm-hmm. Because I have, I have n particles that are 400, so actually the dynamics is still not that bad compared to n gamma. Mm-hmm. But now what happens is that I'm started to go and approach this steady state. What happens is that the mean field, in this case, I'm going to go to point D, and point D is where, according to the mean field, everything starts to be almost normal, except here a region that is super radiant. But otherwise, everything is normal. Mm-hmm. And what happens here, if I look at the dynamics of the inversion versus time, something like this. So the mean field, of course, is oscillating periodically, now kind of rabbit flopping. This is JC. And the exact solution, what it does is that oscillates and it starts to damp with the same period. And then damps, here goes to zero. You are in the normal phase. In principle, you are in the normal phase. But according to mean field, and then it takes forever. Well, this is up to now gamma t, you are going to go to 5. And then what happens is that then very slowly, it reaches the steady state that we want. So there is this very flat. So according to the mean field, you would say, oh, I'm having an average zero. But it's just you have to have times that goes exponential to the time t, independent of the particle number, until you go here to the steady state. So this is this pre-thermal phase that appears in the dynamics. So the point is that at the mean field, there is a very abrupt change. When you go here, you have a critical, you have here a critical, a first-order phase transition. But the point is that this is exactly what you see in the exact solution. If you don't go to very long times, but imagine that you cut your times here up to a certain amount of time, that is exactly what you see in your exact solution. So what happens is that if you look at your Liouvillian spectrum, if you look at the spectrum of your Liouvillian operator, what does happen is that, in fact, the excited states of the system start to become gapless. So after there is a point here, so in this region, there is a gap in the Liouvillian, in the spectrum of the Liouvillian. Here becomes gapless, and then in this region you start to see the imaginary part has to have some positive value. So that's what happened. So the ground state, in the steady state, you don't see anything, but it's in the excitation spectrum that you see a transition from a gap to a gapless system and oscillatory behavior. Mm-hmm. So this is what is happening very interestingly. So let's see. There is, however, then this issue of the spin squeezing, because when you try to look at the spin squeezing, and I'm going to finish soon, what happens with the spin squeezing is that you see that it takes forever. I'm going to plot the spin squeezing now as a function of time, the spin squeezing as a function of time, you see that the spin squeezing, so this is star. The squeezing parameters start to be so zero, log. I'm plotting log these squeezing parameters time 10 in dBs, and then it start to zero. Then you have some transient dynamics. You get the spin squeezing. You have some crazy things, and then at very very long times, it reach the squeezing in the steady state. That's very takes very long. But the point is that if you are not, this is at the very close to the critical point. If you are trying to avoid this critical point region a little bit far, and you, so if you go, instead of being here at the critical point where the squeezing is maximum, you go a little bit away from it, then you have less squeezing, but much faster. So that's the trade-off. So at some point, what you are going to see is that if you are going to go, not, you are not going to have that small of a squeezing, but you are going to have something like this. In the transit, if you go up far away, you are going to go something like this, and then very quickly saturate to a lower value of spin squeezing much faster. So that's in principle what the experiment needs to do. But interestingly, and that's something that's what we are now studying, is that this is when you are assuming that you have no other sources of noises. So or the only noise that we have here is collective emission. If you start to add spontaneous emission, like single particle spontaneous emission that is non-local, what we see is that the system does here, goes here, and at, when there is a time scale that is 1 over gamma, there is the possibility that you start go here, then here, and then you have reached lower spin squeezing, more spin squeezing, and then you are kicked out and start to generate very badly. So I want to conclude this talk saying that, in principle, we see that even with some local sources of decoherence, what happens is that spontaneous emission can speed out the dynamics. And what is happening is that spontaneous emission is reducing your effective end. And if you, so imagine that you are stuck here, far from the transition. What happens is that you are decreasing your effective end because of a single particle decoherence. You are shrinking your block vector, and you are bringing the critical point closer to where you are and increasing the spin squeezing. Very, very counterintuitive. Very, very nice for the experiment, very counterintuitive. And that's what we're exploring now. There are measurements already done in the experiment. They see the dynamical phase transition. They still don't see squeezing, but that's hopefully in the short term happen. I talk too much, so I don't know if you have, we don't have too much time, but if you have more questions, I'm happy to talk to you. Or unless there is something very urgent now. Okay.